We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Jessica, and today we are welcoming Alan Shim to the Zoom studio. Alan is the Chief Financial Officer at Slack, a business communication platform with almost $1 billion in annual revenue. This winter, Slack was acquired by Salesforce for $27.7 billion. At Slack, Alan oversees global operations, investor relations, corporate strategy, business analytics, and more. Prior to joining Slack, Alan served as the VP of Finance and Treasury at YouMe, a data analysis platform for television advertising, where he helped drive its growth from a startup through IPO. Now let's get to the bottom line.
So you receive your undergraduate degree in economics from Wharton, and also a CFA charter holder. Was there a class or experience that you had in college that really helped shape your interest in startups? And just it generally, you can take this as how has education influenced your career?
So for me, I'll talk about school, but I think education starts much earlier than that, right? Because for me, I was raised, and my parents are immigrants from Korea. My dad's a small business owner. So that was actually my first exposure to entrepreneurship, was to see him, you know, navigate and continues to run a small business to this day. And I think that really instilled in me the value of hard work, perseverance, sacrifice, which I carried into the way I approached school and then ultimately the workforce. At Wharton, you know, I don't think I realized at the time, but looking back, I had a really broad business education. So I learned a little bit of management, I learned a little bit of marketing, I learned a little bit of finance, of course, accounting, statistics, and even legal studies, which ended up serving me really well because I, you know, when I worked at both YouMe and Slack, they were very small, young companies. And the problems that you have and the different challenges that you have as a small company, there's a high premium you would put on adaptability, the ability to kind of navigate a lot of these different situations, and having that breadth gave me some of that flexibility and ability to navigate this various set of challenges. But I would say if I had a favorite class though, it was negotiations, because that is great for life. But more seriously, I would say, you know, when you work in a business program, the biggest change that I noticed, but I think this may be true now for more undergrad programs broadly, is going away from very individual focused work to group work, right? Because that's really where all the magic happens, is how you work in teams, how you can enable this, you know, kind of this synergy that comes from working with other people, and then related, how you communicate. So the ability to communicate your idea as well, but then there's also a degree of public speaking that kind of ties into that. So this ability to communicate clearly and effectively was what I think a particular premium. It's something that I think Wharton in particular set me up well for.
Now, that's amazing. That's good for me as well. I also recently took a class on conflict resolution and negotiation. And I can also say that it was one of my favorite classes to take at Harvard. So I think also applying that more broadly to Harvard as a liberal arts institution, there's always this stress on receiving that breadth of education. Not just in one field, but in allowing students to try classes from different concentrations. So I think that's also something that's comforting to hear for a lot of our audience who come from that type of education. Want to get into learn more about your experience at YouMe, where you held a similar role as you do at Slack in helping to drive growth all the way from the startup period through an international expansion, all the way to an eventual IPO in 2013. How have you been able to apply those learnings at YouMe to your position at Slack? And to what extent were these maybe different?
So first off, it's funny that I'm talking about YouMe and Slack in the same conversation, because they could not be more different companies. They're very different markets, very different teams, very different founders, very different cultures. But for me, you know, I got to join YouMe about 30 people. I got to join Slack about 20 people. There's a lot of similarity in terms of my experience there and a little bit to what I was just speaking to. But specifically with YouMe, I would say, you know, it's a little bit of this classic, you build something, you build a product, and then you distribute it. I mean, that's sort of the arc of business in a lot of cases. And so in YouMe, the emphasis and my focus was quickly around how do you go and do that? How do you go and sell something? How do you distribute it? And in our field, it was, you know, hiring a sales force, putting them into different markets, hiring them across different countries, looking at the different market opportunities, and then kind of resourcing and investing it accordingly. But I think the part that was most interesting for me out of that was, I don't know if you remember from grade school when you took social studies, they do the class where it says, here's how a bill becomes a law. And then you go through like this maze of options that is the US government and the legislative branch to get from one end to the other. And I think there is something really insightful about that, that to sell something is not just one act. It is this entire myriad of processes that really are not visible to the, you know, the untrained eye, or even the folks that are involved. They don't quite understand like how the step got back to them. I often talk about work as this relay race, right? That the way you can really be most effective is if you know how to both receive a baton and hand a baton. Doesn't matter how fast you are, right? You could be the fastest person in the world, but if you don't know how to receive a baton or hand a baton as a team, as a race, overall kind of racing team, you're gonna fail, right? And then when I look at that for Yumi specifically, understanding how kind of this, you know, this idea of go to market, you hear that term a lot. Like, what does that even mean? But it is putting these pieces together between, you know, kind of like the bill becomes a law thinking, so that you can ultimately get products out to your customers, that you can, you know, weave that into how you position, how you package them, how you support the growth of those products. And I think that was a really critical piece for me. The other one that it would be remiss to not mention is, you know, going public, my first time working on a public offering. And everyone loves IPOs. Everyone loves, we did a direct listing at Slack, but, you know, it's kind of same difference for this conversation. And I would just say, and maybe for this audience, not quite as relevant, but, you know, IPOs are like weddings. Right? Weddings are super fun. Like, everyone has a blast, and like you take all these pictures and everyone's just smiling and happy, and you've got all these great memories of it. Being a public company is like marriage, and that's hard. And that has a mixed track record of success. And I would say at Yumi, the thing that I learned was that we viewed it too much like a wedding and not as much, we didn't prepare as much for the marriage. Whereas at Slack, we took the opposite approach. I put much less emphasis on the event itself and much more. We actually spent years preparing to be a public company and being ready for that over time. And that has really served us well. Again, it's a fairly young company. I mean, it is saying something, I think, when I remember, kind of when I think about it. You know, I joined the company early 2014. Within just over 5 years, we went from launching the product to being a public company, right? And that is not a normal timeline for companies. And I think that's something where being very intentional about that was really served us well. Coming back to Slack for a sec, you know, the history of Slack is very interesting. It started as a game, pivoted into this communication platform. And from there, you know, we went from, notably to kind of relate it back to Yumi, we went from this very organic viral adoption. So people were recommending it on Twitter and to their friends. And then it became quickly, well, it's not just for these smaller tech teams in the Valley. It's actually for these huge companies all over the world. So how do you sell to those companies? Well, you need a Salesforce. And that was a big evolution of the company strategy, which was then now again, okay, where do we hire these people? What markets do we want to be in? How do we structure that? And then for me in the CFO role, how do we invest behind that? Because now all of a sudden a big chunk of money that you didn't really spend before is newly being spent into creating this capability. So I think that was a really helpful lesson. And I would just say, you know, I really thank the folks at Yumi in particular, because everything that I feel like I did at least better at Slack was on some level because Yumi was my training ground for it, but, you know, such is life.
Right. And I really do appreciate that comparison. And you'd mentioned that it's perhaps talking about IPO is not as relevant to the day-to-day of a student founder, but I think students are really interested in that because a successful exit is what we're all shooting for, even at these like very early stages of students working on their own ventures or who eventually have plans to join a startup and go through that. So your experience is really interesting to hear about. Something that, I mean, I was reminded of when you were talking is just your, as you were explaining how teams can be successful related a lot to the mission of Slack itself and just how to enable better communication between different teams. So I want to go back a little bit and chat about what in general was very compelling to you about Slack that caused you to want to be involved. And then more specifically, do you have a favorite feature of the current platform?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So I'm a business person. I'm not necessarily like a product person, although I dabble and at best. I would say what was most interesting about Slack was really aligning to the team that was there. You know, if you talk to, and I'm sure you've interviewed VCs on this podcast as well many times, you're investing less in the idea than in the person, right? You're really believing in what that person's vision is, where they want to take it, the energy and everything that comes with that, right? That belief and that energy. In a lot of ways, I was investing in Stuart and the founding team of Slack as well, because I really believe that there was a very complementary set of skills that I could bring to that organization. I had seen scale from, you know, their size up to through a public company. And I was the first business hire. So I had all this other set of knowledge and experience that frankly, they just didn't want to deal with. Insurance and bank accounts and all these other things around how does a company get put together. And that really worked out really well. And of course, the idea that it was growing was very, very attractive. But I don't think anybody involved at that time had any idea that it would become what it would become at that point in time. I mean, I think quickly through 2014 and 2015, as you know, we grew and the product was evolving, we saw how customers were adopting it. The vision became a lot clearer pretty quickly. But at that point in time, we were just trying to keep up with like 20% week over week growth for 20 weeks in a row. And that was insane. So when I think about Slack though, what has become very, very apparent to me now. So I do a lot of customer meetings with other executives because they'll ask me, you know, other CFOs or even other CEOs, and they'll say, okay, great. My team is super excited about Slack, but how is this relevant for me? Right. And I'll say, well, I'll say two things. One, you need to understand that you might not think you have a communication problem, but that's because you're the CEO or the CFO. Because anytime you want information, guess what? Somebody gets it to you. But for everybody else in the company, that's not true. And it's very, very hard for them to have access to the context that they need to do their job well. And Slack really upends that, right? I think that the beauty of Slack is it takes this paradigm of like individual inboxes and flips it on its head and says, everyone in a team should have access to that information. Not everyone's a writer, like Twitter or all the social media that we have. Very few people write, but a lot of people value it for the reading. And I think it's the same way for channels, that what you see in the consumer world has an analogous value proposition here, where if we can all have access to that information, and which is just the fundamental proposition of Slack, it will make the team go a lot better. But the point is that, you know, channels really offer this new paradigm, a much more modern and relevant paradigm to how we work. And I think that is the fundamental thing. Now, what ends up happening is you get a lot of channels because you start to have a channel for a project, you start to have a channel for a team. And the number one feature that I value is what we call sections, which is basically like folders for your channels. So you have folders for your email, but we have folders for channels. And now instead of I've got 100 unread emails overnight that I wake up to, and I've got to create all these, you know, very arcane rules in with my Outlook or with my Gmail to put them into all these different folders. Instead, what I can do is I can create sections, and the things that I care about, the things that are actually my priority, are where I can go and find information, where I go and spend my time, right? Because the inbox role is very much about whatever is most recent is most important, because that's at the top of your inbox, right? That doesn't make any sense. That's not how we actually live our lives. And definitely you can't operate at scale that way. So when you think about, okay, well, what's important to me? Well, this strategic project is important to me, or this, you know, this team I need to keep tabs on, or, you know, the status of this customer is really important to watch. That is the way we actually do work. That is the way that we can prioritize. And that's the way I think information therefore now starts to reflect the way that we actually think, the way that we actually work. And that I think is the beauty of technology. Once it actually aligns to the way that you do things versus the way that, you know, you kind of try to force your behavior and you start to modify the way that you think and you act around that. The other feature that I think is super useful for Slack is bots. And that sounds super techie and very technical, because I don't know how to program personally, although I know more and more people are doing that. But the beauty of bots is that it takes information that is really accessible for you that, you know, you could definitely find if you wanted to, but it pushes it to you when you need it. So the best example I have for that is a bot we created called Anniversary Bot. And basically this tells me all of my teams, because it has all of my team's information, because it knows my org chart based on my HRS system. And it tells me their birth date, as well as their anniversary date of when they joined Slack. So every time they hit their birthday, I'm right there sending them a direct message saying, happy birthday, Virginia, happy birthday, Jessica. And I look like the best boss around, when it's really the spot that's reminding me to tell, wish them a happy birthday. And the same thing for when they hit their anniversary mark, which is really, you know, special for people when they think about, hey, I'm now 1 year in, 2 years in, and I can say, hey, happy, you know, 3 years, we call it Slackversary. And I think that's the power of when we can take, again, the information that's already there and then leverage technology to make our human experience richer is particularly powerful.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the product has enabled Slack to really undergo this period of such like steady and rapid growth. So we want to chat a little bit about that. First, for you as an individual, what has been the most stressful part of your job as the CFO of a company that's just shy of $1 billion in annual revenue, but also just that has been growing so quickly over the past couple of years?
When I think about my job as a CFO, there's a couple of ways I look at that. I have many different stakeholders. You know, as a public company, investors, they're an interesting bunch. There's a wide, you know, variety of investors. And I'm sure you've talked to some of them through this podcast as well. And they've got a certain set of requirements and things and priorities and things that they're concerned about. So I think that's a specific relationship. And that's, you know, a little bit more about consistency and making sure that we deliver on what we say. So managing expectations, but also delivering against those expectations is really, really important. But then I would say it's really about employees. And I think there are two levels of that for me. There are employees, the big E, little E, you know, there's, because I'm the CFO of the entire company, right? Not just the CFO of a few different teams. So I'm the CFO of the entire company. I have to think about, how does the organization work collectively as a whole? How does our capital, how does our investment enable our teams to work well across the whole to achieve the company objectives? And then there's lastly, myself as a department leader, you know, manager of people, you know, one-on-ones and all hands meetings and such. And, you know, there's some overlap between those last two. And I would say that increasingly as a CFO, I am not managing things. I am a leader. And I think that's a really subtle but important distinction that I have my own definition of, which is about moving away from being just specifically managing the outcomes and the tasks and the deliverables, and much more elevating that to leading people, inspiring them, motivating them, aligning them, giving them the tools that they need to succeed. And that is a different job entirely. And I think that evolution has happened while the company has grown, while I've kind of, you know, during my tenure as CFO. And I think that's something that I will continue to keep growing and learning on for the foreseeable future.
Amazing. I'm going to pass it off to Virginia for our next set of questions.
So we want to talk a little bit about the recent news with Salesforce acquiring Slack. Specifically, how has Slack's financial strategies propelled you to the recent announcement to set an acquisition price for Slack at a $27.7 billion enterprise value?
It's hard for me to comment on the specific price for a number of reasons, but I would say that, you know, Slack is clearly a very unique company out there. We believe and we know that we're the leader in our category. We created this category, and we believe it's an increasingly important paradigm for the future of work. And I think this pandemic, this remote work, these Zoom, you know, interviews and whatnot, it's not just about, okay, here's this change that we all made. It's actually an acceleration of the world that I think that was to come, which is more distributed work, more flexible work. And it really just pulled forward all these years of change into the last few quarters here. Similarly, in along that line of that vision, this transaction, this combination is about acceleration. It's about accelerating what we believe would probably have taken 20 years for Slack to accomplish as a standalone company. As a combined entity, it will probably take us more like 5. Because we can now reach customers so much faster, right? We've got the scale, and we talked about go-to-market earlier, you know, really supercharging the go-to-market, particularly with our enterprise customers, both bringing on new ones as well as expanding ultimately to wall-to-wall. We have a number of very marquee customers like Amazon, like Verizon, like a number of other number one in their space type of brands that you would recognize. They are wall-to-wall on Slack. They are doing, all the employees in their company are doing their work on Slack, connecting with their teammates, and now increasingly with their vendors and their outside partners outside of the company that is on Slack. And that acceleration at the customer level fuels also this acceleration of what I'm alluding to, which is our network, which is what we refer to as Slack Connect. So if you could imagine a world now where not just the people inside the company walls are on Slack, but outside of the company walls that are key to how you get your work done. And that network, this really first of its kind B2B network, is accelerated and expanded faster. That is extremely compelling. And then lastly, we have really large developer populations who are building on each of our respective platforms. And so mobilizing our nearly 1 million developers and their, you know, much larger trailhead kind of population, and having them build on what we believe is the platform for how work will get done in the future. And I kind of mentioned some of the smaller examples with the bots, but if you can imagine even more, from ranging from things like that anniversary bot to something more complex, like sophisticated workflows where, you know, you might create macros in Excel today, but imagine that in a much more connected set of steps where people get onboarded in an automated way, where they get recruited, onboarded, provisioned their computer, created their new email address, created their new Slack ID. All of that happens automatically. And then bringing those populations together, I think, creates a really compelling platform for how work gets done in the future. So I think that's really what it is. You know, we believe that the future is happening right now. The idea that we will go back to the way that things were is nonsense. We can debate the degree of change that will be persistent from here, but it will be different. It will persist in some form or fashion. And we think that this combination presents a very compelling set of both, you know, I think assets and capabilities, but also value ultimately for customers in terms of setting them up well for what that future looks like.
Well, congratulations again on the Salesforce acquisition at a $27.7 billion enterprise value. You know, that doesn't happen every day. So beyond the quantitative value, how is Salesforce a compelling acquirer from a qualitative perspective in terms of mission alignment, culture compatibility, and potential to scale Slack even bigger?
There are a lot of similarities and things we share in common. So they're both founder-led. They both have very visionary type CEOs. They both created their respective categories. Salesforce created the cloud and cloud services, cloud software back in 1999. And, you know, we created our category in 2014 when we went public, when we released our product from GA. But I think because of the founder, a lot of things stem out of that because of the similar impact to having a culture that is really customer oriented, having a mission and a values driven organization. Salesforce in particular has values around, I believe it's trust, equality, customer success, and innovation. I mean, those are things that, you know, when we would articulate them probably a little bit differently, but those are things that we very much adhere to as well in terms of customer trust and really continuing to be an innovative company that will, again, drive what we believe is the future of work from here. So I think there's a lot of alignment there. There's a lot of common belief, vision, and ambition to becoming creating a much larger benefit for our customers and ultimately creating much more compelling value for what we can do together.
What advice would you give founders who've raised either a seed stage or a Series A round on minimizing costs and maximizing runway?
the very simple advice I would just say is, you probably have heard, and this is probably literally true for a lot of those folks, is just treat it like your own money. You know, if you don't need it, don't get it. And the problem with spending, especially on a business perspective, is it quickly becomes, feels free, right? It quickly becomes, well, hey, that's just another, you know, soda pop or kombucha in the fridge there. I'm just going to take that home with me. And that's, while in isolation is trivial, it actually speaks more to the culture that you want to create around that. So I would say, you know, if you're looking, trying to save runway, the simple advice is just don't buy as much stuff. Figure out a way to make that go further, both from a practical reality of you know, saving the money, but more from a significant beyond that moment and that transaction, the culture that you want to create in this organization. Because I will tell you as a CFO, once you decide to give something to employees, you can't take it back. It will be very costly to take it back. And so those all should be investments that you're making into your employees or into your organization in some way, that maybe the ROI isn't quite as tangible as when you buy a piece of machinery, let's say, but that there should be a thought around what is the purpose of that versus that means something to you versus having someone, you know, just having, you know, kind of rationalizing a decision. Or the worst part is not thinking about it at all.
Yeah, I think not thinking about it at all is definitely the worst. This is a little bit different, different topic, but especially in times of the pandemic, we'd be remiss not to discuss COVID. You know, Slack has offered a solution for team communication and remote work. So what advice do you have for teams working remotely? And how can we facilitate better communication virtually?
There's a lot of consistent themes and thoughts, I would say, from what we were talking about earlier. But at a very fundamental level, I would say a high stress environment like this, or a high stimulus, a very strong stimulus environment, elicits a very strong response, right? And that response, by the way, is not something that is manufactured by the environment. That response is really, it just took that much pressure or energy to kind of pull that out of you or cause you to act in that way. So this environment is not necessarily causing people to change versus revealing what was already there and bringing it more visible, bringing it to light, making it more visible. And what I mean by that is, it's not that we knew that teamwork was hard. We always knew that, but we just worked around it and allowed ourselves, and on some level, you know, kind of resigned ourselves to a degree of inefficiency and a pace that came with that. But what did this kind of catalyst trigger in us? It forced us to recognize that going at that speed and working that way is not sustainable. And it's definitely not competitive the more you go forward. And so being able to be flexible in the way that you work, being able to question and challenge the status quo is something that, you know, I don't think people nearly did as much on their own. But when you have a pandemic, all of a sudden, if I had told you in February, your entire company is going to be working remotely tomorrow, you would say, you are crazy. But guess what happened in March, mid-March? The next day, their entire company was working remotely and it happened. So it's not that it's impossible. It's that we do not find enough will and intent to go and challenge those things. So I'm purposely being a little bit broader, because I see this show up, obviously, in the way that we work, but even in a lot of micro ways beyond that. We have, for example, rethought how we do meetings. Right, because meetings used to be very much kind of formal, if you will. Right, that, you know, you had everyone went through a slide deck. There was a PowerPoint or a Google slide deck, and you kind of went around that. And there was a kind of a normative behavior around that. And I said, why are we doing this? This doesn't make any sense. We're not even in the same room. So why do we all need to just stare at the Zoom screen together? Why don't we restructure that differently? Because, by the way, one Zoom call is, you know, that's fine, probably helpful. 8 Zoom calls on a given day starts to be pretty exhausting. And so you need to be able to, yes, adapt with them. But if you only take, I actually like the way our future form VP says this, if you only transition what you did in the kind of pre-digital world into the digital world, you are not going to get something good. You're going to get something probably worse. But it's until you look at that and say, we need to transform this from the old way into the new way, do you get that real benefit? And I think Slack is actually a real example of that too, because I'm not just saying take email inboxes and shift it over into this other thing with a better UI and, you know, new color palette, whatnot. I'm saying flip that paradigm upside down from inboxes into channels, from disconnected tools into a connected platform, right? From all the people that could possibly ping you, kind of being able to access you, to only the people that you want to work with, and only whether they're inside or outside your organization. That sounds like, when I say that to people, like, wow, that sounds too good to be true. And I'm like, that is happening right now. And I think the beauty of this moment is that people are now opening their eyes to what's already available, because that it's first breaking that inertia, getting over that hump, that mental hurdle of, well, it's always been done that way before. And if I ever said that to Stuart as the reason for doing something, I would be fired. So I think that's baked into our ethos, but it's also very relevant just given what's happening in the world. And I think as you kind of apply that paradigm, you can see that happening. And the companies, here's the thing. If every company was failing because of this, that's one thing. But how many companies are out there that are actually doing so much better because of this, which is a crazy thought to think about. I mean, not because they are benefiting from this in some way, but because what's different about them, they have adapted, they have evolved, or that their practices have given them the ability to adapt at a pace that this situation mandates and requires. You cannot wait now for the next year strategic plan to do that. And so I think in a nutshell, like, that is a real accelerant, right? And I think that's something that we're seeing from customers, we're seeing for ourselves. And it's a constant, you know, beginner's mind type of moment for all of us that I think companies are really starting to appreciate.
That was a really great answer, and really hits on the notion that, you know, startups are made to disrupt industries. So I think a lot of people, especially pre-pandemic, you know, have the mentality of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, like you said, there's so many more companies doing better off now than they were pre-pandemic. So great insights there. So we want to, you know, end off with our question that we ask every single person that we interview. And to get to the bottom of the bottom line, we want to ask you, what is your hottest take or your most controversial opinion? It does not have to be related to Slack. It could be anything that you've talked about before, whatever you'd like to say.
Not really one known for controversy, so maybe that's not the answer I would pick. But I would say I see a really, really exciting, untapped opportunity to actually what we were just saying, but in a much bigger scale. So, and what I mean by that is really just rethinking, how does entrepreneurship, what does, like, the future of entrepreneurship look like, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, right now it's very kind of all or nothing. It's either you're a for-profit, capitalistic, you know, money machine, or you're a foundation and you're a nonprofit and you've got this very social purpose, but that means you make no money, you have no livable wage, you've got, you know, and it's such a stark contrast. And I find that very puzzling, because there is so much good in both buckets, and the amount of, or the limits or the lack of crossover is really, really surprising. I mean, you have companies that say, I have to either be a C corp or a B corp, you know, and like it's this very, you know, we're very much about labels, and I understand the reason why some of these things happen, but that's not the way that we live. And what ends up happening is it accentuates the greatest parts of each piece, but it also accentuates the worst parts of each as well. So you can make a bunch of money, but it's at the cost like nobody else shares in that wealth creation. Or you can do a bunch of good, but then the people that do it suffer because they have to sacrifice so much to make that happen. And I've pretty much my whole adult life has been in Silicon Valley. I'm not saying something that's so novel. Like, there are a lot of smart people that live here and everywhere in the world. And yet I think because we are in our own little bubble, we don't allow ourselves to really see it in the same way. And I think in the same way with the pandemic, it has always been true that essential workers were essential. We just call them that now because now we see that happening. And it sounds silly, but the person that delivers your food to you has always been doing that. And now you're like, you're an essential worker. What the heck? I mean, it's really, really confusing to me. I don't have an answer for that by any means. But actually, what I really liked about talking with all of you in particular is that your generation really inspires and motivates me, because you have taken, like you were saying, you're like, why are we doing it this way? That just doesn't make any sense. Why would I inherit that system? I would want to build a new system. And all I would say there is, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater while you guys are going on that crusade. We can all work on this together. And I think that is the opportunity of your generation, of my generation as well, in terms of our legacy, because there's a lot of broken stuff out there and there is no one size fits all solution, but the power of technology, the power of entrepreneurship, the power of capitalism reimagined in the 21st century is going to be the difference in all these other issues that we talk about: climate change, social inequality, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm not trying to diminish those things in and of themselves, but what is the mechanism that will make those things happen? So that's all I have to say about that.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, be sure to check us out online at harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram at harvard_ventures. See you next week for a new episode of The Bottom Line.